Get back! You two, stop that!
Philip! Stop!
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello and welcome to Sordid Cinema, the official podcast of SordidCinema.com. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined as always by Mr. Ricky D.
What's up, Simon?
And we're also joined by Patrick Murphy.
My mind is still blown from the Alien Covenant info you guys gave me earlier. Sorry, I'm still reeling a bit.
We can maybe talk about that later. But we're also joined by special guest and Goomba Stomp Indie Games editor, Katrina Lind.
Yo, what up?
Not much. We got a full dance card. We got a full stack of hosts. I'm excited for this. So this week we are going to be talking about an oldie, but I think a goodie, and a newie, possibly a goodie, in the form of It Comes at Night, the new film from Trey Edward Schultz. And did I butcher that? I actually didn't. Wow, Trey Edward Schultz. I got it right the first time. He wrote and directed, and we're also going to be rewinding a little bit to talk about a celebrated recent-ish horror film that we never actually did get to talk about on the show. It's called The Witch, but we'll get there a little bit later. Ricky, is there anything you feel like the folks at home should hear about? I mean, obviously, for people who have been visiting the site, E3 is like just bombarding everyone's senses.
Yeah, we've been pretty busy with E3. I would highly recommend people check out your podcast, the Twin Peaks podcast, which I listened to last night. So yeah, if you're watching Twin Peaks, listen to that podcast. And I guess that's it.
Yeah, I'm having a blast doing that show. And I can't wait to record our episode about this week's episode, which was amazing. Yeah, anyway, that's enough about Twin Peaks, since probably there's a decent chance that a vast majority of you aren't watching it. Let's just get into it. Let's talk about Trey Edward Schultz and It Comes at Night.
I think that Will and I should be the only ones who go outside for a while. We don't know what made Stanley sick. We don't know anything. Nobody touched him, so I think we're fine, right?
Positive.
You just opened the door, right? You didn't go in.
I didn't touch the door.
You didn't what?
It was already open.
What? The door was already open when you got there?
Yeah.
Then who opened it?
If you're lying to me, I will kill you.
It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay.
You're back on Sordid Cinema. That was a clip from It Comes at Night, a movie set in present-day Wisconsin where life is unlivable and everyone is trying to kill each other. No, that was a mean lie that I just told. It's actually set in a nebulous sort of post-apocalyptic society where a disease ravages the land and claims anyone who doesn't take adequate precautions, which is why one family in particular played by Joel Edgerton, Carmen Ejogo, and Kelvin Harrison Jr., take quite a lot of precautions, including generally wearing masks when they go outside, and, as you might have guessed from the title of the film, not going out at night unless absolutely necessary. This very carefully ordered system gets disrupted when some more people show up, played by Christopher Abbott and Riley Kia. I'm not sure. I love her, but I'm not sure how to say her last name. And, you know, Kia. Anyway, as you might imagine, things go sideways. It's a genre film. What do you expect? Katrina, I'm going to start with you as our guest of honor. Have you by any chance seen Krisha, his previous film?
I have not.
I wasn't personally a fan, but I feel like people who really like this movie might dig it. In any case, what are you having not been on the show before, are you do you consider yourself a horror aficionado? And I guess more to the point, would you consider this a straight horror film?
I wouldn't consider it a straight horror film. I'm more of like a horror fan. Like, I'm not into keeping track of like all the directors and producers and actors in certain horror films and kind of really digging into that horror culture, but I tend to watch as much horror as I can. This to me kind of reminded me of if The Walking Dead game meets like an art house student film. And I thought it was really beautiful in that it's in its cinematography and its way that it conveyed its motifs and its plot. And so that's not normally seen within horror films.
Yeah, when you say student film, that sounds like potentially a barb. Do you mean that in a nice way or a mean way?
I think I mean it as a bit of a barb. Because it seemed to not really do any, it didn't take enough risks for me. And so it seemed to just kind of do like an experimental thing that you would see in like your friend's film project, that they did for film school, and not something that like a seasoned filmmaker would make.
Interesting. I mean, that's a point that I think we're going to come back to, but, I'm actually most curious to get your take on this movie, Patrick, because it's such a spare screenplay and such a spare setup, and you're sort of our resident script nitpicker. So did you feel like there was enough meat on its bones?
Not quite, though I didn't think that it was completely bare. I thought at many points the script was stupid. Like, it needed to write characters were clearly written to do things that smart characters would never do. And we'll, I can get into specifics later. There were a lot of things that bugged me and had me just chuckling at the movie at how dumb these smart people really were. There always needs to be something that screws up a perfect situation, right? And it has to be utter stupidity. But regardless of that, while I didn't think it had much of a point, I think the film is basically empty. I mean, what you see is what you get out of this one. It does carry itself fairly well, and it did keep my interest long enough for me to I enjoyed it somewhat, but I think it's also very, very forgettable.
Can I take that as your pull quote for the movie, Patrick? I enjoyed this dumb, empty movie.
It wasn't always dumb, but it just had punctuations of absolute idiocy. That's all I can say. And that's obviously intentional on the script's part. Like, they couldn't figure out a way for things to go horribly, horribly wrong without somebody doing something stupid. This movie is not the first one to do that. It's not even the first decent movie to do something like that. But it definitely takes it down a couple of pegs.
Mm-hmm. Ricky, how many post-apocalyptic horror movies have we reviewed on the show over the years?
Way too many.
And do you think this one manages to distinguish itself enough to be worthy of our time?
Yeah, I kind of like the movie. I think the problem with the movie is I think it's mismarketed. And A24, they're actually really good at marketing their films, especially the way they cut their trailers, because they don't show too much of the movie, which I really appreciate. But the problem with the trailer for this movie is I went in not reading anything about the film, just seeing a trailer, and I was like, okay, it's a horror film, I want to review it. And I kind of felt like I was going to get like a traditional sort of like ghost movie or, I don't know, just something completely different than what we actually get. Now, as far as the movie goes, like for me, this is a movie about internal demons, not external demons. And so it's a movie about grief, dealing with grief, and how grief is something you process. And I think that's what's interesting about the movie. Like, I'm still processing the movie, much like I would process like grief for a long period of time. And I think that's what the movie's trying to get at. Like, it's just a movie about grief, and it's something that never really goes away, even though people say it's going to get better, and it maybe will get better, but it kind of sticks with you for the rest of your life. I think the director makes some bold story choices. I like the way it introduces a mystery and ends with somewhat of a cliffhanger. I'm not too satisfied with the ending of the film. I kept wanting more, and I think my biggest criticism of the film is I think it would make a really good short film, but I think he stretched out a really paper-thin plot or narrative into about 90 minutes, and he didn't have much to work with. Yes, the cast is uniformly great. I think everyone's solid. I think they all do a great job with what they are given. In terms of like the character choices, I agree with Patrick that sometimes I found a little unbelievable that these characters, the way they are presented at the start of the film, would make some really silly mistakes. And I don't know, the way that they turn on the family that they bring into the home in the third act just seemed too sudden and abrupt. Mm-hmm. Which is weird because the movie takes its time. Like, it's sweet time. Like, this, you want to talk about a slow burning pace. I mean, this is a film that really has nowhere to go anytime soon. Like, it takes its time getting to the next camera shot. Forget about the next scene, you know?
Slow burning.
So, man, but I really think that this is a film that's going to polarize the audience, as we can see right now in this podcast. I'm curious to know if you like it or dislike it, because it seems Patrick doesn't like it. Katrina's sort of, like, mixed. I like it, but I just expected so much more. But it's a bleak, sad film, and it offers no relief. And so it's a really tough film to watch, because there's not like a second, not a moment in this film where you can actually just sit back, relax. I don't even think that there's a part in the movie in which one character smiles. Katrina, you mentioned The Walking Dead, and it's funny because I used to like The Walking Dead. I hate The Walking Dead now, but I could not help but think that the way the episode is structured, like, I'm not talking about like in terms of like the way it feels, like the setting, the tone, the acting, the musical score or what have you, but just in terms of like the narrative structure, like what the movie's actually about, it kind of does feel like an episode of The Walking Dead. And I kind of feel like this could have been a 45-minute TV show. I kind of feel like they could have like taken a script and crammed it into like one episode of a TV show, made 45 minutes long. I think the problem is that the movie just doesn't give us enough. And so it's weird, Simon. Like, I admire the filmmaker for what he does, and I kind of feel for him because it's a very personal film for him. Like, he wrote it right after his dad died, and you should actually go read up on some interviews with the filmmaker. He had like a really rough like upbringing, and you know, like, so I don't want to trash the movie, and there's no reason for me to trash the movie because I do think it's a fairly good movie. I think it's extremely well made. I love the way it looks. Like, I like the use of the widescreen. One thing I noticed, and I don't know if you noticed this, Simon, is he actually changes the aspect ratio throughout the film, but it's so subtle that I don't think most people would even notice.
I didn't
actually notice that.
Oh, there you go.
Sorry.
The screen had it did change. You started to notice little black parts at the bottom of the screen. It was very weird. I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me for a second.
This is one of those newfangled horror films that doesn't necessarily work for me as a horror film, but I did appreciate it as something else, in the same way that I appreciated It Follows as sort of an askew coming-of-age story more than I appreciated it as a horror film. I appreciated this more as sort of a tone poem than as a horror film. I think that its attempts to be a horror film were actually quite disruptive to my enjoyment. Like, there are...
The thing is, sorry to cut you off, but the thing is, it's not intended to be a horror film. Like, that's one of the things that the director actually said in this interview I read, that he was sort of, like, bummed out that the studio, although he appreciates the fact that they're trying to get the movie to get more, like, butts in the seat and sell tickets, he didn't really like the fact that they market it as a horror film, because to him, it's not really a horror film in the traditional sense.
Right, but he did make a movie with jump scares in it. There aren't many, but there are a few. At least in terms of like the way the sound mixing especially is handled. Like, there are some rather overt contemporary horror filmmaking moments in it. Not a lot, but maybe a half dozen. So I think it was fair game for A24 to cut the trailer that way. That being said, I think that the movie is at its best when it's not leaning into those elements as much. I will say that when the movie ended, I was left with that same kind of empty feeling that Patrick described, but I'm glad that we've had, I saw it a couple weeks ago and we're only just recording this now. I'm glad that I've had that time because it's one of those movies that sneaks up on you and grows on you as it starts to get, as it has that second life post-screening in your mind. Unlike a lot of other films I've seen recently that shrink immediately after I watch them and I just can't remember a goddamn thing about them.
You know who I really liked in the movie? I liked the son. I thought whoever that actor is, I thought he did an amazing job playing that character. Like, the way he portrayed his fear and his angst and his, like, grief and his shock and his terror. Like, I just loved his performance.
That's Kelvin Harrison Jr.
The funny thing is I absolutely hated his performance to start the movie with for like the first 20 minutes or so. And I hated all the sort of nightmares things. But he gets so good as that movie goes on. And he really does become the anchor of that movie. Like they intended for him to be. I did not think that was going to happen. That's one of the few times where a performance has gotten so much better for me over the course of a movie. He did a fantastic job. Him and, well, everybody did great. But yes, he definitely was a key element.
I don't know, man. The little boy sucked. I'm just saying. Okay, but wait a minute. As soon as the movie opens, you know what kind of movie you're in for. Like, that opening scene is so painful to watch. Like it's like I went in thinking I was going to get a different type of movie based on the marketing. But as soon as it opened with that scene where they have to kill the grandpa and then bury his body and burn his body, I was like, okay, I know what kind of movie I'm in for. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was going to say, I didn't like the first shot. I think that... That's my problem with the opening. First shots are so important, especially in a horror movie, to sort of set everything, set the tone and basically introduce you to what you're going to be going through. But I don't think that first shot represented what we were going to be going through in this movie. It was of the grandpa staring at the camera with his boils and everything like that. And he held it for quite a while and then it slowly pans around and it finally gets to, I think Sarah was her name, Joel Edgerton, Paul's wife, right? So it sort of like slowly comes around to her, but he's not really, I don't even think that you could make a case that obviously this is, and you said, the director said you're dealing with death in this movie. He dealt with the death of his parents and thing, or his father. But I don't think that shot confused me for a long time because the rest of the movie, I don't think really has anything to do with that.
Okay. I got a question for you guys. What comes at night?
Well, what more do you want? It's it.
No, like I'm asking an honest question here because like, okay, like we're going to talk about The Witch later and a lot of these horror films, like I'm not just talking about the title of the horror film, but a lot of horror films are left to interpretation, which I love, right? Like you can look at it one way and then Patrick can like have a different interpretation of the film and so on and so forth. With this film, I'm not sure he gave us enough to work with to walk away analyzing a film for each of us to come out with a different interpretation of what the film is actually about apart from it maybe being about grief. Like, for example, who opened the door and killed the family dog? And why was the teenage boy drawing pictures of Slender Man throughout the whole entire film? Like, I'm not saying I needed answers to these questions, but it's just like it's shoved into the screenplay, into the film, but it seems like there's no reason for it.
There are very few payoffs in this movie. Very, very few. There's no payoff to the sort of father-son dynamic that develops between Will and Travis and sort of that three-way with Paul sort of looking on jealously. I mean, it's kind of present, but it never really develops and goes anywhere. There's nothing really with the father dynamic, with the losing the father dynamic. I'm not really sure what they're doing with a lot of the stuff. He didn't really seem to go anywhere with many, many things, which is why I ultimately thought it was kind of empty.
I'm going to disagree with both of you. I think there is actually like quite a bit to pick apart with what it could be. Because it could honestly be the dreams, it could be the, it almost seems like chaos. Like, to me, I kept noticing all the lines, like when they were in the house, all the shots were of these really straight lines. And then whenever anybody moved out into the forest, everything would kind of go in this kind of chaotic feel. And I first noticed that shot when it was the mask of the son, the kid, and it was like blue on top with these straight lines of these trees and then like a fire burning under it, and that was reflected in his mask. And so my first thought of the movie was, oh, this is going to be about chaos. And I think it's about just the order and nature of humanity and what kind of chaos that can dive into. And that you have all these like structured things, but I mean, ultimately that can just go away really quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that to an extent. I would even expand that to say that something that really strongly connects this movie and The Witch is that these are movies about people who live in isolation in a very rigid fashion. You know, we're going to talk about The Witch later, but here in this movie, you know, the Joel Edgerton character really some of the only exposition in the movie really carefully lays out what their system of rules is. And, you know, these three people live in total isolation. They don't interact with anyone else. And except for when they do, it's, you know, fraught with danger. And I think my interpretation of what it is doubt. It's the idea that the chaos that Katrina was mentioning is sewn into the fabric of the order they enjoy. The order they enjoy is inherently unstable. It is waiting to be loosed. It's not tenable. So, you know, who exactly killed the dog? Who exactly left the door open? It really doesn't matter. Because the whole point is that the life that they've created for themselves is not worth living in. Which is like, oh, this is an entire movie about people who are eking out an existence that isn't worth existing, which is a very, very bleak idea. But I think it follows that to its logical conclusion.
It's interesting because what I kept thinking, and I get what you guys are saying, what I kept thinking is like, the actual house is their safe haven. But it's weird because it's not really a safe haven in the traditional sense of the word, where like it's like peaceful and calm and you could just feel at ease and relax and rest. It feels like they live more so in fear when they're inside the house boarded up than when they're actually outside, even though apparently outside is where you can become a victim to the disease, right? Like this is a... But by the way, and that's another thing I don't understand too, is when they're outside, sometimes they wear their masks and sometimes they do not wear their masks, which left me completely confused. Anyhow, the point is that they're inside this house, and like you said, Simon, they have like these rules, but it seems like because they're so scared of actually quote unquote living, they're actually making their situation worse by confining them inside like these walls. And I like the idea of like the red door and like what's behind the red door as if it's trying to get in. But I don't know, like it's one of those movies where there's a lot going on, even though technically there isn't much going on. And so when I walked away, all I can think of is that this is a film about grief and that's it. And I don't even know what else to say about it.
I would add to that. I mean, there's this whole other dimension that we haven't mentioned yet, which is that sort of like psychosexual dimension to the movie, which was welcome to me because a lot of horror movies these days are so desexualized, so it was nice to sort of have that be an element at all. And I'm of course referring to Travis and the way he starts to sort of listen in on these new inhabitants, and you know, obviously develops a bit of a thing for the Riley Keough character, and that ends up sort of lacing all these interactions in a really loaded way. And you know, it you know, they're emphasizing the fact that he's, you know, an adolescent kid living in isolation with no prospect for, you know, human enjoyment in that way. And I thought that was really nicely handled on a performance and on a performance and script level.
Yeah, everybody around him was getting some. That would have been a horrible thing to have to put up with, especially for an adolescent kid.
The true horror is everyone else getting laid.
Yeah. People were really horny in the apocalypse in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Sex comes at night. That could honestly be it.
Well, all right, we solved it. He was having some weird dreams. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can see almost all of what you're saying, these being elements of the movie. I just didn't see any commentary on it. So for me, there's not a whole lot interesting then involved in any of that. So yes, it could be talking about chaos, and yes, it can be talking about grief, but I don't see the film take a stance on it or have anything really interesting to say about it.
Why do you have to take a stance?
It doesn't have to necessarily, well, it should have a perspective. Let's put it that way. Perspectives are interesting. Just
it has a perspective. The perspective is these things are very, very bad.
Well, the perspective is of the kid. It's of the son, because most of the film is in his point of view. Not all of it, but most of it.
I don't know. His dad's point of view is a big part, too, though. So I'm not sure that that's necessarily even the case. And that's the thing. The film flits back and forth between whatever its themes might have been. What it starts, it just kind of jumps back and forth between them and never really sticks to anything. I mean, as far as like the chaos thing, they all know that it's dangerous out there. They're living inside and they're well aware of it. There's no juxtaposition between the outside and the inside, really. Yes, they're living an orderly life, you know, indoors, but they're also living an orderly life whenever they go outdoors. So there really isn't a whole lot that it can say about that, or that it doesn't really make any impact because it doesn't have anything to say about that.
Well, okay, like the whole chaos thing, like I understand what Katrina and Simon are talking about. I don't really see it myself, Patrick, but I do see like this underlining theme or this metaphor of grief. I mean, the whole movie, the characters are dealing with grief because the movie opens with them killing the granddad. And then there's like the dog dies. I mean, the fact that they're living in this cabin in the middle of nowhere because they are too afraid to enter into the world because they're afraid they're going to get sick and everyone in their lives has most likely died. I mean, that's clearly there. You know, like, again, it's a film that I do admire. I mean, this is a low-budget horror film. It takes chances. I'm surprised this movie even, like, opened wide in so many cities. Like, I kind of feel like this is normally the type of movie that gets released on VOD. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even get, like, a theatrical release. I do love the way he thinks cinematically, in the sense that like he's got a low budget, he's shooting digital, but he shoots these beautiful widescreen images of the surroundings, of which, you know, let's face it, like he's mostly shooting in one location. Like they do sort of like venture off for a bit into the woods, but they're still within close proximity of the actual cabin. And I like the way he keeps things in shadows and off the frame and relies heavily on atmosphere and sound design. And I do like the soundtrack. There's a lot that I like about this movie is what mm-hmm. I'm saying. I'm not crazy about it.
Yeah.
And the problem here is that I wish I was crazy about it because I love my horror films. And I, like, again, like the marketing is problematic. At the same time, it was great because it did like pique my curiosity. I did want to see the film because of the poster, because of the trailer. And I know when I was in California, that's all people were talking about was this movie. Everybody wanted to go see it, like all my coworkers and colleagues. And I guess I'm more disappointed in myself for not liking it.
I just want to be clear too, that I did not hate this movie as much as I'm a treasure. I actually agree with you, Rick. Like I like the atmosphere. And I said early on, like I did enjoy this movie, believe it or not. I think it really does. There's some good filmmaking chops behind it. And I did appreciate the way it looked and the atmosphere that it set up. And I liked a lot of the characters. Like you said, most of my criticism comes from disappointment that it wasn't better than it was. Mm-hmm. And I know that's maybe not fair, but that's just the way that I felt about this movie. I was hoping that it was going to go somewhere really good and it didn't ultimately, but the ride was fine.
It's not really an unfair criticism because I feel, and I think you feel the same way, is that there really isn't much of a payoff at the end. I mean, the end is traumatic, and I do like the performances and what they pull off, but I just, for some reason, I just needed more.
The third act did not fail in this movie. It didn't quite succeed fully, but it did not fail, that's for sure.
I would like to concur with Ricky's point. From my own point of view, I am the most disappointing aspect of any screening I go to. I appreciate the film. I liked it a lot more than his first feature, Krisha. It's really sort of grown on me psychically since I've seen it. It probably helps that I'm recording this podcast in near total darkness. So it's getting me in the mindset because the film's sense of darkness is quite ravishing. And Katrina also mixed but somewhat positive feelings, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's mostly positive, but I left the theater feeling kind of like my stomach hurt from all the stress. And I'm a huge fan of like character driven story. And I kind of got that sense throughout the whole movie. I'm like, all right, this is going to be like Travis's story, or it's going to be his dad's story. And it just wasn't. And I guess that left me feeling sad that I wanted to know more about these characters, and then you never kind of you never do. And I guess that left me feeling disappointed. So I'm like mostly positive, but didn't totally love it.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to potentially, for you know, thematic reasons, keep touching on It Comes at Night. But we're mostly going to be talking about Robert Eggers and The Witch. You are listening to Sorted Cinema.
The way we like to run things, and we think it's important. You know, I think it's important to keep a routine and stay busy.
Oh God, I'm sure I'm forgetting a few things.
There's plenty of time to work out all the details.
Yeah.
Overload. Well, just settle in.
Yeah.
And we'll get working in the morning. And welcome.
That's perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, buddy. He's hiding.
Why are you hiding?
Conjure thee to speak to me. Speak as thou dost speak to Jonas and Mercy. Dost thou understand my English tongue? Answer me.
What dost thou want?
What canst thou give?
Wouldst thou like the taste of butter? A pretty dress? Wouldst thou like to live deliciously? Wouldst thou like to see the world?
What will you from me?
Dost thou see a book before thee? Remove thy shift.
You're back on Sorted Cinema. Now we're going to rewind slightly to talk about a much lauded recent-ish horror film that we never got to talk about. And it seemed to be apropos since, you know, we're dealing with the same studio and some of the same themes. The movie's called The Witch, written and directed by Robert Eggers, with Anya Taylor-Joy, Ralph Ineson, and more folks. Of course, it's set in 17th century New England. A Puritan plantation. Everyone is very pious. Everyone is very God-fearing. And things start to go freaky when, of course, the witches they've been so afeard of, along with God, start to bedevil this pious community. Most sort of importantly, beginning with the theft of a baby. Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't this premiere at the same Sundance as The Babadook?
No, I think this was a year after.
Anyway, yeah. It was weird.
This premiered the same year as Green Room, and these were my two... The Green Room and The Witch were my two favorite films of 2016.
It's weird that 2 years in a row, Sundance like ended up producing, or like being the staging ground for some of the best contemporary American genre film. That didn't used to be true. Anyway... I swear I will stop taking pot shots at Sundance now. So I guess you've spoiled us, and you're a fan of this movie. Why? defend your position.
Why? Yeah. Why? Oh my God, why not? There's so much to love about this movie. There's not a flaw in this film. I love everything about this film. Now, at this point, I'm assuming that most people who are listening to the podcast have already watched The Witch. Like, what I love about this movie, it is a horror film, right? But it reminds me a lot of my favorite Michael Haneke film, White Ribbon, which is one of my, like, 20 favorite films of the past 20 years. Like, I adore that movie. And, like, the thing about The Witch is, put aside everything about it, about, like, possession and the devil and the actual witch, and it being, like, somewhat of, like, a straight-up horror film in a sense, it's really open to interpretation. Like, you can side with the supernatural or the metaphorical. Do you side with the good and or the evil? Like, you can have your own reading of the ending, and Katrina can have her own version of the ending. I can think it means something completely different. But what I think it really boils down to is that this is really just like a family drama, and it's about a family losing themselves through religion, losing their religion, losing their faith, their focus in life, and finding whatever scapegoat and explanation that they can find in order to try to make sense of everything bad. Right. In order to try to make sense of all the bad things that are happening in their life. And like, that's what's so scary about the actual movie. Like, to think that people at one point in time, and maybe even today still do, like, actually think people are witches and into witchcraft and blame those people for whatever's wrong in their life. Like, the whole idea of, like, witch hunts is terrifying. And so I think, like, watching this movie, we're watching sort of like a personal private tragedy of this family, but more so it's like a prequel to a larger scale catastrophe just waiting to happen, much like Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon. So it's sort of like sowing the seeds of suspicion and leading to stuff like the witch hunt, like 20, 30, 40 years later. And that scares me. Mm-hmm. And although the film is never specifically dated, like, I think based on the press notes, it takes place sometime around the year of like 1630. So this is like 10 years prior to the beginning of, I think, like, the Scarlet Letter, and like maybe 40, 50 years earlier than the Salem witchcraft trials. And what's interesting about the director is he actually grew up next to Salem. So he's been fascinated by witches and witchcraft since he was like a little boy. And he's had nightmares and dreams, and he's always wanted to make this movie. And he actually used to work as a set designer and a costume designer. And he used to like build sets for movies and like TV shows. And he spent apparently like 5 years just doing research for this movie, to the point where like the whole entire script is taken from transcripts. They actually built a farm, like the actual setting, like, of this movie, like, the actual farm. It takes place in, like, it's actually filmed in Ontario, but they built the farm from scratch, and they actually had to teach the actors how to be farmers. He wanted everything to feel natural. Mm-hmm. The movie is lit naturally. Like, he used a lot of candlelight for like the indoor shots. And when he would shoot outdoors, he wouldn't want to shoot in like the bright sun. So he would wait for like the clouds to like come across the sky. And he would wait for like specific moments in the day to get those outdoor shots. So he could just get that atmosphere. And like, that's what I love. Like, there's so much I love about this film, but it's like, it works as a horror film, but it works in so many more levels as well. Like, this is what makes a good horror film. This is like a great horror film. This is like close to a masterpiece in my book.
And do you know how long it takes to get a goat to sound like that? It's a lot of work.
Which is funny, because he broke like all the rules of like filmmaking, like page one of like filmmaking rules not to break, which is like, do not rely on children actors, don't film with animals, like all of these rules. And he just ended up doing it. And I think he shot the film in like less than 30 days. I think it was like 26 days. He had like a small budget that he was working with. Yeah, there's so much I got to say about this movie, but I think that this is like one of my favorite films of all time, at least one of my favorite horror films of all time. I love it.
Dang. All right, Patrick, you going to rain on his parade?
No, I'm 100% with it. Like, this is one of my, this quickly shot up the list to one of my favorite horror movies, and just playing one of my favorite movies of all time. I love just soaking in the atmosphere of this movie. Just the cinematography, it's so gorgeous to look at. Every frame is gorgeous, and he holds his shot so long that sometimes it seems like he's focusing on things that periphery things, as if they're actually important. You don't really know a lot of the time what's important. This movie is a big puzzle. And like Rick said, there's all sorts of different ways of interpreting it. You can interpret it literally, or you can sort of do it metaphorically. You can think that you know, main character Thomason is having the entire thing is a dream. There's all sorts of theories surrounding this movie. And in you said it reminded me of Haneke. It reminds me of John Carpenter's The Thing, to tell you the truth, because I have debated that movie many, many times with friends, because you can never quite get the whole picture in Carpenter's The Thing. And you can't hear either. And they both movies focus on seemingly important things that later on play out to be absolutely nothing, but they're throwing you off. And yet at the same time, everything is very, very tight. This is the example of a tight script where everything comes together at the very end. And things that are set up in the beginning, even an innocent line about possibly seeing an apple tree, pays off with the ejection of an apple later on, and in a very important way, in a meaningful way.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was going to say that everything in the first act, there's a payoff for that one scene or one line in the third act. Like, everything comes full circle. And, you know, like, when you talk about influences, it's interesting you bring up John Carpenter's The Thing especially, but Carl Dreyer comes to mind, mm-hmm. clearly. And I think he said he was heavily inspired by Cries and Whispers, but also, of course, Stanley Kubrick, specifically The Shining. And I got to tell you, like, the scariest, most frightening thing about this film was the two little kids, the twins. Those dudes are, like, creepy as hell. Like, I don't know what it is about twins. No offense if you're a twin.
They're so good.
But, yeah, there's something about twins in movies, like, especially with The Shining in this film. They are creepy.
Oh, my God. When that little girl starts saying that she's that whole scene where the little girl comes up and says she's the Witch of the Woods, and then Thomason takes that whole thing. That is such a brilliant scene that pays off so well later on when nobody can trust anybody anymore. And these little innocent things, you know, that was Thomason's own possible guilt over, you know, her own sins or the way she looked at herself. You know, maybe she didn't want her family to see her as a good person, even though she was trying to be. There's so much going on in this movie. Mm-hmm. So much of Thomason's character is so fascinating, how she's, you know, growing into her own and the mistrust that comes with that, you know, from her parents wanting to possibly sell her because she's having an effect on them that is, you know, less than ideal, to her brother, you know, taking a peek every now and again as he comes into his own. There's all sorts of ways that she is affecting her family, or at least it's perceived that way, and what she thinks of herself because of that. Her own self-esteem is affected because of that. And she has her own wants and desires that are completely shot down. They're restricted by the rule of her father.
The way it deals with sexuality, and especially with madness overtaking women, that's where I think of Cries and Whispers. In terms of, like, the visual style, like, it doesn't look like a Stanley Kubrick film, but in some ways, the way, like, the camera moves and, like, little things like having the twins and, like, the pacing and the atmosphere and the soundtrack, that is why I think of Stanley Kubrick at times.
Katrina, are you similarly besotted with this movie?
Yes. And for I love everything that you guys have said so far, and I completely agree. And I also really fucking love this movie. So weirdly, my minor for my bachelor's degree is in Shakespeare studies. And so part of what I did for my studies was studied Jacobian era witch hunting with King James's demonology. And what I loved about this movie is that it takes things from the Malleus Maleficarum, the witch cult hypothesis theory of the 15th through 17th centuries, and King James's demonology, and treats it as though it was fact. And it stays true to that era and what they believed. Like, if there's one witch within a village, there must be many. In order to make witches fly, you need to burn the fat of children. And all of these, like, weird little nitpicky things that you wouldn't think about in relation to the devil and demons and all of these things that essentially is so kind of saturated in our culture now that you could just kind of pick and choose from. It chooses to take them from the source and stay true to that. And I loved it. Like, I love that they just treated it as though it was like a historical, almost like a historical documentary depicting witchcraft.
You call it nitpicking, Katrina, but you just try to fly without burning the fat of children and see how far you get. All right.
I want to hear you talk more about Jacobian witch hunting.
Yeah. So, King James, King or Queen Elizabeth I died toward the latter half of the 16th century. And then King James from Scotland came over and ruled over Scotland. and England, and he was really into paranormal stuff. So he wrote like this whole book called Demonology while he was the king, and it talks about witch hunting and how to like kind of be able to tell who is a witch. And then also the Malleus Maleficarum came before that. And I think that was written in the 15th century. And that deals with how to actually like get rid of witches. But like the Jacobean witch hunting is basically all this stuff they show in the film, which is, you know, if there's one witch, that must mean there's multiple witches. Witches then must sign a contract with the devil, like they physically sign something, which you see Thomasin do. And that it's mainly just like all these women who convene and you must find them.
So, okay, I got a question. Okay, so the actual script, like the movie, comes directly from period journals, diaries, and court records. From where, though? Like, does anybody know?
I think mainly, well, in New England, a lot of that, I'm sure the you know, court records and stuff might be, but also probably England, just like you were talking about. Those books that you were talking about, I'm sure, obviously, a lot of stories. Were there stories in that books or in those books, or were they just kind of like textbooks?
They were fact books that all these people believed were fact. So they were, like, they're historical texts now, but, like, when King James, like, wrote it, he wrote it to inform people of how to deal with witches.
But
like,
did they give examples in those books? Like, did those books contain like supposed real life examples?
Yes.
Can I interject here, because an old friend of mine actually wrote a decently long essay for earlyamericanists.com. I swear to God, she's a historian. She doesn't normally write about film, but she wrote this really great piece about the witch, because this is a period that she's really interested in. And I'm going to read an excerpt from her piece, because she talks about this exact thing. And I quote, "Because of Eggers' avowed interest in the history surrounding his film and his commitment to some form of, quote, accuracy, going into the movie, one of the things I was most interested in was how Eggers would explain the phenomenon of witch belief and witch hunting. As anyone whose work brushes up against 17th century Northeast knows, the literature is vast and the explanations many, ranging from the psychological, a la John Demos' Entertaining Satan, and gendered, explored best by Carol Carlson's Devil in the Shape of a Woman, to the stresses of the intercultural war, explored by Mary Beth Norton's In the Devil's Snare. As it happens, the witch samples in varying amounts from each of these." So
yeah, that just went over my head, dude. I just want to know, is Black Phillip featured in any of these journals? Because Black Phillip's like the star of this movie.
I think I remember him saying that the goat wasn't really... He found a couple of paintings where goats and were present with witches, but the goat wasn't really a symbol of the devil or something like that, or didn't have anything to do with witchcraft for quite a while, not until more recent times.
Patrick's actually right, because the goat being sort of like a symbol for the devil came later, I think in the 1800s. Yeah, and I know this from watching a lot of Hammer films. Although it could be wrong, because they are Hammer films, let's be honest.
No, but, like,
but I think you're right, though, Patrick.
No, Black Phillip was, like, the original. Like, he was the one who invented being an evil goat.
Well, the witch cult, like, hypothesis, which, when it first began, like, years even before this period, it happened around, like, a cult that worshipped the horn god of fertility, so, like, a pan type symbol, which then evolved into the goat with the paganism. So the goat has been like a demonic symbol for actually like a while, but I think it didn't become prominent until the 19th century. So,
and what about the baby being turned into like crimson body wash? Where does that come from?
That came from not wanting to shoot a baby for an entire movie.
There's some really unsettling images in this film, which is a good thing, because it's a frightening film, but not in the modern horror movie sense.
He cuts away from a lot of, like, he cuts away from the violence. He might show you a bit of gore for a little bit, but he never lingers on anything, and often cuts away before the really, you know, quote-unquote interesting thing is going to happen.
Well, it's the actors that deliver that sense of paranoia and fear in the audience, because you get, they're just so, I mean, we got to talk about the cast eventually, but they're so good in their performances. Like, for example, when a specific character gets killed by Black Phillip, you don't actually see it. And as most likely because he just could not film that without, you know, using CGI, which of course he's not going to do. But the camera cuts away, like you said, Patrick, but it's the performance you get from the dad and the daughter. It's just so incredibly gripping. Also, what I found really interesting about reading up on the making of the movie is that he actually altered the camera so the aspect ratio would somewhat change and it would be a lot taller than it normally would. Like that, he can capture all of the tall trees. And so the idea was that he really wanted the audience to just become absorbed in the movie and feel like they're surrounded by the trees and the woods and the forest and like sort of like they're suffocating and it's supposed to have this claustrophobic feel. But also it gives like us, the audience, a sense that like everyone's always looking up into the sky, even though they maybe aren't. But it's like, or something's always looking down on these characters, like sort of like judging them. It's just, it's really interesting the way he shot this film. And again, the fact that he only uses natural light and candlelight in the indoor scenes, which of course recalls like something like Barry Lyndon, like Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, in terms of like how he shot that film. Like the lighting, the cinematography is just like beautiful.
I think what really impresses me about this movie is that here's a movie that was the product of so much research and time and obsession, and, you know, these very specific areas of interest for Eggers. And sometimes when movies are labored over too long, they're the result of too much research, too much personal interest. You get the sense of a, you know, movies usually like that usually end up overstuffed. They end up sort of academic, they end up sort of distanced. And what's so impressive about this movie is that it doesn't have any of those qualities. It takes these characters and their faith as seriously as people from that period you can imagine would. It doesn't feel like there's any attempt to contemporize, look backwards at these people, to judge them for their faith. It seems to take them at, you know, seriously, and it seriously reckons with what it would be like to live that way and what it would be like to live that way in a world where these forces are real. It's a really impressive feat of screenwriting that he's able to fold in this research but still forge these very real emotional connections between the characters and between the audience and the characters and not have them feel like museum pieces.
It also takes the genre seriously. Like, he's not afraid to shy away from the fact that this is actually a horror film, where some filmmakers would feel the need to shy away from, like, the horror movie tropes. And not to say that this film has, like, cliches, although, you know, it does have the goat. It does have sort of, like, the apple, which is a callback to, of course, Adam and Eve. But it's not afraid to be a horror film, and that's what I love about it.
It also has the creepiest rabbit ever captured on film, I think. That thing's eyes? Come on, people. I don't want to look at
that. Yeah, it's a creepy rabbit. I mean, rabbits are kind of like low-key creepy.
I've always liked rabbits, but I don't like that one. There's something wrong with its eyes. He gets imagery, though. He definitely understands like archetypal imagery. He knows exactly what to point his camera at that will get the maximum impact visually. And that's what makes it feel like the folktale that he's saying that it is. It definitely feels like a fairy tale to me, like an old story. Like you said, Simon, it doesn't feel like he's making any contemporary commentary or anything like that. He's just telling a really, really, really good folktale. And there's a reason folktales have, you know, been around for hundreds of years or longer. And that's because they generally appeal to a much deeper part of us. And that's why this movie really was, it was one of the few movies that creeped me out after watching it. I never felt over creeped out while I was watching it. I was just utterly absorbed. But after I was watching it, it sunk in and, you know, I in the dark, things got a little, you know, a little weird.
It's so creepy. The sound design, and it's not just like the soundtrack, like the score, which we can talk about because the score by Mark Corvin is amazing, but it's also just like the sound design, the sound effects, and even at times when it goes quiet, which makes it even more creepy. But I love the way the composer just establishes the film's mood right from the beginning. And like, I don't know, it just, it's like the actual instrument, like I can't pin it down. It's not a harp. It's not a violin. I don't know what the hell it is, but it sounds unusual. And that's the thing about this movie. Like you talk about how much research you did, Simon, and how that could have been a bad thing. But I think it paid in spades because when I'm watching this movie, everything feels natural. Like it feels real. It feels lived in. Like the family, the clothes, the house, like it kind of feels like I don't know. It doesn't even feel like it's a set or costumes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they actually built like an actual farm. It's not like shot on a Hollywood studio lot.
Yeah. And I think that like Eggers clearly has, and again, this is a function of both good scholarship and attention to filmmaking, where you develop like a keen understanding of not just their beliefs, but also just, you know, the rhythms of the day. Just sort of the banalities of their life before this sort of terror sets in, which is just as important. And I think that's something that sort of is shared with It Comes at Night, although I think this movie sort of does more with it. I would even extend that to a movie like It Follows, which is very much about these very rhythmless, structureless lives sort of being invaded by, you know, this external force. I think another thing that this movie does brilliantly is, you know, in a lot of those Hammer films, there's this really corny idea of being seduced by evil. It's of course, inevitably like women being seduced by evil and seduced by the devil or whatever. And this film contains maybe the most sort of elaborate and like psychologically believable seduction by evil forces of maybe any film. And maybe it's just because it takes up so much of the film's sort of psychological space. But it's really beautifully developed in like a really disgusting way.
So you want to talk about feminism? Which scene are you talking about?
I'm not talking about a specific scene. I'm talking about the whole relationship with Black Phillip and how we sort of gradually build to the payoff.
Everybody had to be pushed. Like, she had to be pushed to her brink before he could actually finally make the offer. Like, to the point where she really had no other choice but to sign the book, because what else was she supposed to do? I mean, she could either risk staying out there and starve to death. She could go back to town and probably be hanged for a witch anyway, or she could do that. And that is the perfect seduction. You've basically given her no other choice.
Well, that, but also there is still a real sense of liberation to those final moments, like a really sick liberation.
And that's the thing, she kind of wanted this. There was half of her that wanted it. She was fighting it the whole movie. She really was trying to be, quote unquote, you know, good. But the seduction works because she kind of desired it. She wasn't being forced into this necessarily. It was a logical choice to make.
And because being a Puritan kind of sucks.
I don't know. There was something about, there was something about the dad that I can see enjoying him as a father, Ralph Ineson. He was a much better character than he played on The British Office. Okay, can we talk about how distinct the characters are in this movie versus It Comes at Night, where the couples almost kind of mirror each other, and so you don't really have... There's not a terrible lot of distinction between four of the characters, right? But in this movie, every single person, including the twins, is so distinct. They're so memorable. They're such rich individual creations that helps this movie and its themes so much.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many times, I'll watch a movie and I'll think, okay, this was a really good movie. This character wasn't very well developed or wasn't very, efficiently sketched out, but that's okay because these other characters were fine. Like, there is Eggers, again, because this was such a labor of love, I gather, he doesn't waste a second with characterization that is unneeded. Like, you're right. He absolutely sketches out each individual character and each relationship beautifully, and efficiently. And I hate to say efficiently because it sounds so cold and rigid, but it's true. You've got a limited amount of screen time and he uses it very well. And despite, not sparing, as you mentioned, like, he does have these long shots of just the surrounding woods, the wildlife, again, attention to the rhythms of life. So he's able to develop this portraiture on both levels just very beautifully.
I was gonna say those shots work on multiple levels as well. So they definitely like sort of establish the rhythms of life and everything like that. But take, for instance, the scene at the table when they're passing around the bread and each taking the bread. And earlier on, you had seen that the corn was I don't know what that stuff's called. Is it ergotism or something like that? Where it was sort of, it had a fungus on it that is hallucinogenic. And so that's a scene that can function in a way as if you recognized what that was, you see that they're eating the bread made from that. And you know that what could be happening from then on out is all hallucinatory. It just gives, it casts more doubt upon all the proceedings. And so that you don't end up trusting the movie, just like the characters aren't trusting each other, which again calls back to the thing for me. You don't know what's real and what's not. And as a result, the tension is just absolutely ratcheted up.
And what is film if not a collective hallucination? I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, everyone.
Well, Katrina, I got a question for you. What did you think of the dad and the mom? Because one of the things I actually admired about the dad was everyone was so quick on judging the girl and blaming her for everything that went wrong and accusing her of being a witch. And the dad kind of like held on to this belief that, no, it's not her, and we can work this out and try to find, like, you know, real answers to the problems. So just kind of wondering how you felt about the portrayal of the dad and the mom.
I thought it was really interesting. I almost felt like the mom, since this is Thomasin is like her first child, and seeing Thomasin kind of grow up kind of takes away that innocence that she had. And Thomasin's now developing into this woman with breasts and sexuality. And I think the mom almost hates her for that. Because you kind of see that the mom now, and I know this isn't something that's very relevant in Puritan society, but you can kind of see how tired the mom looks. And I almost see that the mom hates her for developing into a woman, and the father hasn't really noticed, hasn't really come to that reality yet. I always saw him as seeing her, like, she's still my daughter. Like, she's not a witch. She's not a sexual being yet. She's still a daughter. So I almost feel like he was repressing those feelings. Mm-hmm. But the mother just did not. She hated her for those reasons.
And I think, like, it works on even more levels than that, I would say. But it's the fact that you can, you know, the arguments that you just, you know, laid out, they help to circumvent, like, having the father be the one, or having really either parent stand up to defend this, you know, theoretical witch, is maybe on its face the one aspect of the script that is a contrivance, like it's sort of a necessary contrivance, because if both parents are just fully against Thomasin from the beginning, it's just a miserable experience to watch. It turns into a Lars von Trier film.
The reason why I asked the question is because in most movies, it would be the dad and not the mom who would turn against the daughter right away. Because, like, in terms of that period of time, like, the witch, the evil witch, represents sort of like men's fears or fantasies about female power, right? And in this movie, he kind of flips it. It's not the dad that turns against the daughter. It's actually the mom. It's her fear of her daughter becoming a woman.
Right, and this takes it a different way.
I like your point about him rejecting it too, or refusing to see that it's even happening. I can completely see that, and that's why he still completely trusts her.
Oh, and I was going to say, it's shown in, like, the shots of how different people perceive her as well, because you have that, like, really memorable shot of the brother looking at her breasts when she's still sleeping, and then I also think that you see that with the mom, too, a few times, but you never see that from the father's side.
What I think is so fascinating, well, yet another thing I think is so fascinating is the way that, you know, because of our own contemporary biases about witch hunts like Salem, and we know that they're false. We know that they're based in misogyny and repression and all these things, and potentially ergotism, yes, among other things. We know that, and so instinctively we kind of, there's a part of us that does root. You know, we agree with the Ralph Ineson character. We say this is not real. This is my daughter. This is not happening in this way. Part of us, you know, we feel for that so strongly, even though we know in the world of the film that's completely false, and she should probably just be killed or something. it's a great piece of sort of like. Again, he finds this beautiful balance of not ironizing, not contemporizing the story, while also sort of manipulating our perceptions about this sort of story.
You know, and it's also a great little, like, if you're into that sort of thing, a little religious rumination. It is, though. Religion. It's a great look at religion, like a very, very thoughtful, interesting look at one, because these are people who talk about grace at the beginning, and that's how you're ultimately going to, you know, possibly go to heaven. And they emphasize at one point, they say the word grace, and yet that's exactly the opposite of how they handle the situation. And though they're praying, they're getting absolutely no answer whatsoever, and they completely disintegrate because of that, which, for people that are so pious, that's an ultimate failure for them. They were supposed to have faith, and they couldn't keep up the faith. It didn't take much for their little idealistic community to just come toppling down.
Right, and for a pious community, there's no, like, you might think witches are scary, but the scariest thing of all is that your prayers aren't going anywhere. Bum, bum. Anyway, we should probably wrap things up. Are there any sort of last elements that we want to single out for praise or damnation?
Well, I think as much as we praise the soundtrack, the script, the cinematography, the direction, we just have to mention the cast.
Yeah.
I think Anya Taylor-Joy is the reason why this movie just succeeds. I mean, not to say that she's the only great performer, because they're all fantastic in my book, but she carries the movie and she is just amazing. I think it's a really brave performance. I love her range of emotions, like the way she can seem innocent and nervous, but then at the same time feel dangerous and just in control. And the dad, Ralph Ineson, I just think he brings tremendous gravitas to the role. And I love his performance. I love his character. Like the mom played by Catherine Dickey, like she drove me nuts, but that's like the point of her character. Who, by the way, Simon, was in one of my favorite films of 2007, Red Road.
Yeah. And well, I of course think of, and Patrick already mentioned this, but of course, Ralph Ineson, I guess he's more recently known for Game of Thrones, but I still think of him as Finchy from the original Office, which is like, wow, what a transformation.
I know. I couldn't stop thinking of that for a little while. I was like, he's such a dick in that show that you couldn't. It took me like about 10 minutes to get over that. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the movie's called The Witch. We're obviously all huge fans. It's also incredible to me that, and again, we've talked about the massive amount of prep work that went into this film, but this is a first narrative feature. He did some shorts, and he did a documentary feature, but this is a first narrative feature, which is insane. I can't wait to see what he's going to be up to next. So that's just about it from us. Katrina, you're on Twitter, and I love your handle. It's Cat Writes a Thing with a K. I take it.
I go by Kat. It's my nickname for Katrina because I don't like my name.
I don't think anyone likes their name. It's just like no one likes their voice, which is why I abhor editing podcasts, even though I do it every week. Anyway, you can find me on Twitter at HollowMinds. See, I've not used my name. I've used an anagram of it because I don't like the real one. Patrick, you manage the NXpress Twitter, yes?
That's correct, yeah. At NXpress Nintendo, for anybody out there who is a video game fan who's listening to this.
All right. And Ricky, are you still running at Goombas.mag?
Man, I do not like Twitter. I tried it. I'm just like promoting articles from the website. So I run the official Twitter handle for Goombastomp, which is Goombastomp.mag. But I also run the Twitter handle for Sorted Cinema, which is Sorted Cinema. And you can check out my podcast with Patrick. We do the NXpress Nintendo podcast. We just did our first part of a two-parter E3 coverage. And I think it's our most listened to episode. So it's a lot of fun because Patrick, Ryan, and Tim were all live at E3. And it was the first time we actually got to record a podcast live at E3.
That's amazing. I personally love Twitter. I come for the film discussion. I stay for the crypto fascists. It's a really good time. Anyway, so that's about it from us. What's coming up this weekend?
Yeah, I think we're gonna review The Lure in the next few weeks. We're gonna review Baby Driver.
We are most likely
going to catch up on some 2016 films that we didn't have a chance to review because we took a year off of podcasting. And we are not reviewing Transformers. We are not reviewing Cars. We are not reviewing... I mean, I think we're going to review Planet of the Apes.
I have a special request. Can we not review Spider-Man?
We are most likely not going to review Spider-Man, although that's a lie.
God damn it.
We'll see.
I'm sick of superheroes, man. Anyway, I guess that's my fault and no one else's. Anyway, thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back next week.
Black Philip Sif, you are wicked.
Cut Frank. Does he really speak to thee?
Cut Frank.
This wilderness will not consume us.
Cut Frank.
Who's there?
Cut Frank.
You've cursed this family.
Cut Frank.
This is witchcraft.
She placed a curse on me.
Why have you turned against me?
I saw it.